Okay. All right. Today is August 27th, 2021, and Adam Negri and I are interviewing Mary C. Turner for the Minnesota Pandemic Oral History Project. Mary Turner, RN, is an a medical intensive care nurse at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. She's working in the hospital's COVID ICU unit during the pandemic. Prior to this, she worked at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis for 10 years. In 2015, Mary Turner was elected president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. She has served in a variety of leadership roles at MNA, starting as a steward and serving on North Memorial's contract bargaining team. She also served on MNA's board of directors and as chairperson of MNA's Governmental Affairs Commission. In addition, she has been on National Nurses United Joint Nursing Commission, the National Nurses United Joint Nursing Commission, since 2011, and serves on the boards of the Minnesota Women's Consortium and ISSA-RUN, which provides empowerment, culturally sensitive health education, and advocacy for Somali women. In February 2021, she was named to President Joe Biden's National 12-member COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force, the only RN on that body. She has received two of MNA's highest awards, the President's Award and the Political Activist Award. Turner holds a degree from North Hennepin Community College. The interviewers, as I said, are Barbara W. Sommer and Adam Negri, and this is a Zoom interview. So will you take us back, Mary Turner, and tell us about when you first learned or began to realize the pandemic was coming to us, to Minnesota, and what your thoughts were as a nurse, a practicing nurse at a major hospital in the Twin Cities?
Okay, like the rest of us, I started to hear about it in January of 2020. And it was probably in the beginning of February that my boss manager on our floor at the time had let us know that we were going to be the COVID unit. We have two med-surg ICUs at North Memorial. We have one cardiac and we have one trauma. And she said, we're going to be the COVID ICU. And I remember having a conversation with her about, because we of course had some trepidation about it, but her rationale was, well, if we're the COVID unit, we'll be the first ones to get any personal protective equipment. We'll be the first ones to get, you know, what we need. So we, and of course, on our floor is where the pulmonary docs, their offices too. So it was quite logical because we're kind of the respiratory ICU. So I remember that. And then we started to hear about the cruise ships and people having it on these cruise ships. And it was, I remember it was the last weekend in February is the first weekend that I came on where we had COVID on the floor, even though in the papers, it said it started middle of March. We were having cases the last weekend in February. And I will never forget that night. I worked 2300 to 7:30 in the morning. And I remember walking on the floor that night and all these young nurses coming up to me going, Mary, Mary, is it true? Is it true? That we get, I get emotional with this. I probably, is it true that we only get one N95 and we need to wear it till it disintegrates off our faces? That's basically what our manager had told our nurses, which of course indicates just how little personal protective equipment that we had. Now you have to understand an N95 before the pandemic was a one-time use piece of equipment. You would go into any kind of airborne precautions type of room. You would wear it once, you'd come back out, you would throw it in the garbage and take a new one. So we were being told we had one N95 to use till it disintegrated off our face. I don't even think we had did we have shields at the time? We might have had shields, but I don't know if we had them that first weekend. After the nurses came up to me and said this, I remember Blair, Nurse Blair, saying, "Mary, how are we going to be able to go to our home to our children in the morning?" Well, I remember at the time, just because they were so panicky, I remember at the time telling them about the H1N1, you know, because I, of course, had lived through that, and how at the time it wasn't too unusual to use one N95 for the shift, you know, to put it in a paper bag and repeat use through the shift. So it had been done before that we had reused them, but never to this degree. So needless to say, right away, the personal protective equipment was a huge issue, and it continued to be a huge issue for well over a year. Okay, so then going on from there, I recall how, you know, and the other thing is we're walking into the unknown. You know, nobody knew what this disease process was going to turn out to be. We knew it was respiratory. We knew that we had people intubated right away. And actually, they intubated most everyone who came in. And the reason they did that is because it was to protect the healthcare workers. And so they didn't until later on did they start to hold back a little bit on intubating people and try them out on high flow oxygen and things like that. At the very beginning, they intubated everybody for the protection of us because we had no protection. So and then we had, I don't know if you guys have heard this, people were intubated, people as they got worse, they were proned, they were put on their stomachs. I recall one at one point describing to a reporter how, when he was saying, well, surely we have enough PPE now. And I said, you don't realize how fast we go through it. When you have somebody on their stomach and you need to turn them back on their back, it takes 7 people. It takes 6 nurses and 1 respiratory therapist. That means 7 pairs of gloves, 7 gowns, 7 shields, and 7 N95s just to turn that person over, just for one moment in time. But backing up to how the disease progressed, and it was shocking, some of the things that we discovered. First, it was the respiratory. Then I remember the next month, it was the circulatory system. All of a sudden, people had blood clots and pulmonary emboli. And so we had to start them on heparin. The next body system that it hit was their kidneys. We were starting to have people were getting on dialysis. And I remember the most shocking of all to me was when we found out that it hit the neurological system, where people were having strokes from it and brain damage from it. That was the most shocking because why I would get so frustrated, and I would also get on the news and try to tell people how this hit every body system. It did not spare a body system. Because people were insisting that, well, this is just like the flu. Well, I'm sorry, but I've never seen the flu give somebody a stroke. I have never seen the flu give somebody a blood clot or give them brain damage. You know, so because, and for me at the time, because I was president of M&A, I was on the news rather quickly, and I was on all the local stations. And at the time, it seemed like I was the only one that was talking about the pandemic. And I found out later that many doctors, et cetera, wanted to say something, but they were basically given gag orders. You know, it was almost like we're trying to hide the extent of the COVID, because that first wave was, it was HCMC, Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial, probably Regents, Bethesda was open at the time. These were the main hospitals that took all the COVID. Not even all of our hospitals were taking a lot of COVID. And for sure, it wasn't like up north at all. You know, so it made it harder for people to believe that it was actually happening. Because the reporters would beg me. They would, oh, can we get pictures? Can we get pictures of what's in the ICU? Can you go and take photos? I said, yeah, and get fired. I mean, I can't do that kind of thing. That's, you know, so that's why I would desperately try to describe what was going on, you know? So I should touch a bit on what it was like on the floor also, especially in those first couple months when everyone was so afraid. The people who did have to deal with it, the other people in the hospital were so afraid. We had, of course, our negative pressure. We had the main doors closed to our ICU area. There was plastic all around, you know, trying to keep it all insulated. And it was literally like, I used to joke, it was literally like people would open the elevator doors right off of our ICU. It was almost like they tossed the supplies out on the hallway and then quickly closed the doors. That's how scared people were to come. We had housekeepers that wouldn't come up there to clean. And it ended up being the same group of nurses that ended up doing the work day in and day out, because everyone was so afraid to come up there. Now, we had some ICU nurses, especially some young ones, that went, hey, we'll never get this experience again. We're going to go up there and work also. But there was our main group of nurses are the ones that did most of this work throughout that winter. It was we felt very isolated. At times we felt abandoned. I know that as a nurse leader, I had a lot of resentment towards our hospital, not necessarily our hospital, our state and our federal governments, because at this time I was hearing about from Governor Waltz, I was hearing about how, Mary, we had another shipment of PPE that was heading to Minnesota. It got to the border and it was confiscated by FEMA. That happened 5 or 6 different times where we had millions of masks that were heading into Minnesota and it was confiscated by FEMA because the federal government didn't have a supply of PPE. And I would hear from Governor Waltz about how the states were having to figure this out on their own and how they were having to, vying for supplies. And all of it seemed kind of ridiculous because I knew that 3M was right down the road. You know, we should have technically, it was right and friendly. We should have had all the N95s, but that's not the way it worked. And so it was the whole concept of trying to protect the nurses I represent has been a huge, huge focus of mine throughout this whole pandemic. I don't know. I'm going to take something to drink here. You just slot in with another question anytime.
What were your thoughts in this early stage when you had these other nurses coming to you and looking to you for leadership? What thoughts and feelings did you have going through at that time?
Yeah. So I remember it was mid-March. I had my 95-year-old father was in one of the nursing homes, St. Therese Nursing Home in New Hope. And like so many, I wasn't allowed to see him for like 2.5 weeks. And he died alone on March 17th, 2020. And we buried him on Thursday. He died on Thursday, buried him on Saturday. And on Sunday, the very next day, I was down at the M&A office helping to collect 80, 80,000 masks from the public. That was probably the first time that I got on the news. I think my paper, what my picture was in the New York Times collecting masks. I told everyone, you can't go to church, you might as well come on down to the nurses. And we collected some 80,000 because we were that desperate. I was getting calls and emails and Facebook messaging from nurses all over the state in a panic because we didn't have any PPE and they were looking to me to get it for them, you know, but what we ended up collecting ended up going into the state stockpile because they didn't have a stockpile either. Nobody had any PPE. None of the hospitals had been, you know, hadn't been seeing this coming. And so it was so frustrating, terrifying in a way, because as we were going into our jobs and being unprotected, and it was extremely frustrating because it's a well-known fact now that this COVID virus is airborne. But they right away said that, oh, no, it's contact precautions. And they just kept changing the guidelines. And I swear they changed the guidelines according to our PPE supply. If that makes any sense, it was like, you know, kind of saying, well, it went to one N95 to, well, now we can wear them for 10 shifts. I mean, I remember being in one of those rooms and having the mask and my shield. And after like day six and you're kind of doing something and you're trying to hit your mask up over around your face without trying to touch it, you know, because it's slipping down off your face. And believe you me, we did have nurses that got sick. We had nurses, and a lot of the nurses that got sick in the beginning were nurses that were out on the med-surg floors because they were telling them that they didn't get any N95s at all. The night that I took, one of my worst nights as a nurse leader was the night that I had to take care of a med-surg nurse from my hospital that was fighting for his life on a ventilator. And I felt so helpless as a nurse leader, that I couldn't have protected him better. And he survived, thank God. He eventually got back to work, but he spent a month and a half on a ventilator, one of my own nurses. And as a nurse leader and a fellow nurse, it was a heart-wrenching night for me.
Mary, when you were, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
When you were collecting those masks, was that the push to sew? People were making masks. They were the pattern was sent out, and these were cloth masks. They were kind of anything that could come in and help. Is that what you're talking about there?
That particular, it was for us, it was like a 5-day event where we actually gathered. People brought N95s. You wouldn't believe how many people had N95s. A lot of them were bringing, you know, because, well, especially all the people that were in like construction and stuff, you know, it was amazing how many people had boxes up them. You know, I remember one person coming up, well, we got a box of these on Amazon, but we figured the nurses needed them more. So people were hearing about it and they were getting their own supply. You know, the event was supposed to last a week, but then it was quickly after that, I think after day five, that's when the governor put us in total lockdown. Then after that, but we were able to collect over 80,000 masks and gloves and shields and all sorts of other supplies. But then it was at that time where they started to say about the cloth mask. Now, keep it in mind, a cloth mask for us wouldn't have done us any good. I mean, that's mainly to catch very obvious stuff. We needed the N95s. We needed the surgical masks. We needed the shields. But at that beginning, the only ones who were getting the N95s, the very few that we had, were the ICU nurses. And so you had a lot of med-surg nurses. A lot of our respiratory therapists all got COVID. Eventually, There's, I think there's at least six or seven of our ICU nurses that got it. And we actually have a few that are still dealing with the COVID long hauler syndrome, you know? And throughout all of this, you know, and I remember us trying one treatment after another. What's that one that President Trump had touted? The hydrochloroquine or whatever, yeah, something like that.
Hydroxychloroquine, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, chloroquine. Yeah. We even tried that for like a week and a half. You know, we tried everything. We tried the plasma. We tried remdesivir. The one that has stayed consistent is the Decadron, is the steroids. That has stayed consistent, and they've been coming out with other drugs ever since. And we try all of them. But I remember feeling not only scared and fearful for my nurses, but a sense of hopelessness, total hopelessness. And because it seemed like things were getting worse and worse, and I was so frustrated with the federal government. I'll have to be honest, because it looked like we had been totally abandoned. And I would ask reporters, I would say, do you think anyone is listening to me? Because I was the one who was trying to tell the public what COVID was all about. And I felt like I was the only one out there doing it. And it wasn't until that fall, when it got really, really bad, like in September and October. By this time, I was already on the state COVID task force. And we started to talk about, look, we have got to find a way to let the people know that this is real. I mean, this is like 6 months later. And I'm like, well, it's about time. That's when the hospitals finally started to let the media into the ICUs, but that wasn't until October of 2020. Okay. And I just remember thinking, you know, if y'all would have done this right away, back when you had everyone's attention and everybody was cooperating, it wasn't a partisan issue. If we would have done this right away, what a difference it might have made. Because back when I was the only one on the news, I mean, the thing that, because we had a couple other nurses that did a story, but then were immediately harassed by their employer, saying, you can't be on the news doing that. And so that's why I always, always introduced myself as President Mary Turner of M&A. And then I would say that I was a COVID ICU nurse at North, because that protected me. And like I said earlier, I've since found out there were many people that wanted to go to the media, but they were afraid for their jobs. And honest to God, I don't know what everyone was trying to hide. We'll quickly take care of this and everything's going to go on as usual.
Were people trying to play down the fact that it was a pandemic?
Yes, it seems so.
And was that coming primarily from the hospitals, from the medical community, more than from the governor, for instance, or more from obviously your leadership or the public health leaders?
Well, I think the problem was that especially that first wave is that it wasn't all over Minnesota. You know, as a rule, like my first vice president is a nurse in Duluth, and he says that up north is about 2 weeks behind us. You know, so that first wave, when we actually had a lot of nurses that were resentful because they were in these critical access hospitals. You remember the hospital association stopped all surgeries and all procedures. And so this was an economic hardship for a lot of nurses that didn't even see COVID, you know? So they were coming to M&A being all upset because their hospital wasn't doing any procedures. And so they were basically furloughed, you know, sometimes with pay, sometimes without. And so it was very much, a real quandary, that first wave, because it didn't affect everyone. So, so of course you're going to have the towns that aren't even seeing it, that were trying to act like, well, this is no big deal. See what I'm saying? But, goodness.
Thank you for doing this. I'm sure this isn't easy, and we really appreciate this. One of the things that's come up in our research is that there were some sort of there were bioethical decisions being made about use of medications like remdesivir and stuff. As a nurse on the floor, were you aware of some of it, or working with some of that? It ended up coming through the COVID Ethics Collaborative and that sort of thing, and the vaccine, you know, the COVID Ethics Collaborative. Was that communicated down to the nurses on the floor as you were? For availability of remdesivir and how to use it, or when to use it.
Oh, right. Like at the very beginning, a lot of mm-hmm. those medications were used when they were at their worst. They were used only in the ICU. It wasn't until later that they finally figured out, you know, maybe we better start using this a little bit sooner in the course of action. That's why I was so shocked. I mean, granted, he's the president at the time. I was so shocked that President Trump got all of these things right away. I went, goodness sake, he's having a little bit of a hard time breathing and he gets remdesivir and all this other stuff. Are you kidding me? And the reason I thought that is because I had patients that they didn't get that until they were intubated and everything. Well, they found out that eventually that was way too late. You know, granted, we had many success stories at the beginning, but it took them so long. The average stay was 36 days, like almost a month and a half. And people eventually got better. And we had a lot of success stories. Whether they all ended up staying out of the hospital or whether any of them ended up with long COVID, I wouldn't know that. But they eventually figured out that remdesivir, Decadron, all of that kind of stuff was better put to use earlier on.
Okay. So that
was came a lot later. That came a lot later.
So that was an understanding of how to use the medication itself or the effectiveness.
Or were you talking about when they were doing research, like placebo mm-hmm. versus, oh boy, do I remember any of that? Mm-hmm. That would have really bothered me if I knew I was giving somebody placebo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I really can't answer that. And that would have really bothered me. When people are fighting for their life and I'm giving them a placebo.
And I don't know how that worked. I know that there were some articles written about how, you know, who should get remdesivir and that sort of thing, you know, what, and that goes into, you know, who's most susceptible for the disease, as I understand. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing.
Go ahead.
No, but what was your question?
Maybe another way of asking this too would to talk about scarcity of resources and for your patients. You know, one of the notable things that we heard about in the news as lay people, right, were a lack of ventilators at a certain mm-hmm. point, right? So did you ever encounter how to choose which patients go on the ventilators? Were there some patients that didn't have access to like the necessary healthcare resources that you would have otherwise given them?
Mm-hmm. We thought at one point that we may have to get to that. We have four ICUs, and at one point we had all four ICUs full with COVID. We had three full med-surg units full with COVID. We ended up having, I believe we had enough ventilators, but I do recall having discussions with the pulmonary docs that if this gets any worse, we may have to be in a, because all the hospitals were getting plans for like casualty type of staffing. And if it would have come to that, if it would have been where we would have had to set up that tent out in front of you know, the 60-bed tent in front of the hospital. And if we got would have been inundated, like they probably are being inundated down south right now, that our doctors would have to come to the point where they would have to decide who to give what to. Fortunately, it never got that bad here in Minnesota, but they did talk about it and they did think about it. And that would have been a decision that, boy, above my pay grade, and I wouldn't have wanted to do it. I totally empathize with the doctors who are having this discussion. And like I said, they're probably going to be having to make those very decisions down south if they're not already making them. But I digress with that. But you talk about shortages. I remember at one point, the part that really, really upset our nurses is when we had to reuse our isolation gowns. We didn't have enough isolation gowns. And nurses, as a rule, don't get politically active without kicking and screaming and dragging them, you know. But this one, they were contacting their legislators. They were contacting OSHA because we had to reuse our isolation gowns. A whole shift. That'd be like putting on a dirty, filthy piece of clothing and just keep putting it on day after day. You know, one that's covered, totally covered in germs and mud and et cetera. That's what it felt like. You know, this is a garment that you would have definitely wore once, thrown it in the linen basket before you went out of the room, and then you would have taken a fresh one. But we were so short of supply all over the city that they had to reuse ISO gowns. And that went on for about a month and a half until they were able to get a bigger supply of them. That was the last straw as far as the nurses were concerned. For me, right away, it was the N95s and all that kind of thing. But for the nurses, it was having to reuse the isolation gowns. That was a breaking point for them.
Was that part of the march on the state capitol in the spring of 2020? Then did that trigger that? There wasn't there a march by the nurses asking for support for protective?
Oh, clothing? Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, it was. Oh, that's where we went from. Oh, yeah. We went from United. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the way up to, I remember that. That was in kind of the spring of 2020. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was definitely had to do with that. I think at the time they had somebody at United that there was an issue where they thought they should have, because they weren't doing procedures. They thought that the nurses should have scrubs supplied to them, but technically scrubs is not personal protective equipment. And all I'm going to say about that, whether I agreed with that fight or not, at the very time that they were fighting for those scrubs, that once they started doing procedures was not going to be available anyway. They were only available because surgical procedures weren't being done. At the very time that battle was going on, my nurses were reusing isolation gowns. Okay. So for me as a nurse leader, to put it into perspective, and some of the healthcare companies were having their nurses use the same gown for a week. Okay. And so I couldn't have this is on a personal, and it'll go into these archives, and no other nurse will hear me say this, but it was really hard for me to have empathy for somebody that wanted to have a fresh pair of scrubs, you know, because our nurses from day one, it's just a matter of given that we all bring our clothes and change them before we go home. You know, some of us at the very beginning, we would go take showers in the locker room. Many of our nurses had shower facilities set up, you know, in their garage, in their basements, you know, change clothes in their garage, that kind of thing. We had all just got our own routines down, depending on what they had to go home to. My heart always bled a little bit more for those ones with all the young children. You know, a lot of them had to take way more precautions before they'd walk in their door and their little one would run up to them. Most of those nurses would change at the hospital. because they were afraid to bring, remember at the time, you know, they made it sound like COVID was clinging to everything, you know? And so everybody, the nurses were so afraid. We were so afraid that we were going to infect our families. So, you know, that added to the stress of the work that we were doing. It just is this constant fear that we would get sick, that our families would get sick. And remember, we had no hope. We had no hope. And that hopelessness for me was compounded by the fact that I felt like our government had abandoned us. And I don't necessarily mean our state, because I knew that the governors, they were even, I mean, even the governors were working regionally together, which is saying something, because we're like, we have run Democratic governors surrounded by Republican governors, and they were all working together to try to find solutions, but without any help. And I remember it wasn't until November, I believe it was November 18th, 2020, when I had the opportunity to be on that frontline task force speaking to President Biden elect. And I told CNN, MSNBC at the time, that was the first time that I felt like somebody was really listening to me. And furthermore, it was somebody who could do something about something, who could do something about the issue. And it was the first time that I had hope. That was the first time. And that was, what, 6 months later?
When you received that invitation, what were your thoughts and feelings? So you have the hope after you've been listened to, but where's...
I was at my brother's kitchen, and my executive director, Rose Roach, called me and said, "Are you sitting down? Are you sitting down?" I said, "Why?" She goes, You've been chosen by NNUS says you've been chosen to be on a frontline forum with President-elect Biden." I was like, "Whoa, that's like really cool." It was me, and it was a school nurse, and I think a firefighter and a home healthcare worker. And we were from all the different unions. And of course, I was the COVID ICU nurse. And then my claim to fame, of course, was that I made President Biden cry on TV. Well, I think I recall telling him about being in that nurse's room that night, taking care of that my fellow nurse who was fighting for his life. Anyway, my claim to fame is that I made Biden cry, the leader of the free world, cry on national TV. So, and after that, I remember doing, like, I think in about 29 hours, I did eight or nine different interviews in 29 hours. I decided at that time I couldn't be a Hollywood star. It was too exhausting. It's too exhausting. But, and then in January is when I found out I was going to be on, I was up for being chosen. Well, Dr. Marcela Nunes, who actually coordinated the event with President Biden, that forum, she's the director of the Federal COVID Task Force. And she submitted my name, or she called me and wanted to know if I would like to be considered for it. And I found out later, because once I was chosen, I found out later, because that first month I was very intimidated, because everybody's the head of this and the head of that, you know, and they're all very important people that are on this. And Marcela talked to me and she goes, "Mary, you don't have anything to worry about. Do you realize that out of the 12 people chosen, you're the only one that President Biden knows personally?" And he said these words. He said, "That Mary Turner is so passionate about her patients. We have got to have her on the task force." So then that made me feel better. That made me feel better. That's pretty special, isn't it? I mean, that's almost better than any award I could get. That's for sure. So
that's an amazing comment from the president. An amazing comment. Do you have anything, Adam? Do you have any other questions about the personal, or we can, keeping an eye on the time, move to talk with you about your president of the M&A. Anything else, Adam, on your end before we move?
Before we move on to that, I guess from your perspective, as you know, as it's been said a million times in the news, as a frontline healthcare worker, and this feeling of the stress and hopelessness that you felt throughout 2020, what would you have liked, with hindsight now, what do you think the federal response should have been?
First of all, the Defense Production Act, that I was beating that drum the whole year. That should have been enacted right away. I mean, we were in warlike situation here, okay? And the Defense Production Act, when it's enacted during a war, everybody drops everything to make planes and guns and whatever, tanks and whatever else you need. And that's what we needed, was the Defense Production Act. But for one reason or another, they never enacted it. And so there was never enough PPE. And I used to say, because I've been fighting for the essential worker on all the different fields this whole time. I've been front and center on that fight. And it wasn't just me, the ICU nurse, who needed personal protective equipment. We have had so many frontline workers die because they haven't been protected properly. At least I would say to people, at least that first day I had one N95. My son, who is a grocery worker, he had his little cloth mask. That was it. I remember hearing, I remember when he came to me one day, he goes, "Oh, I'm so frustrated. I was loading up the vegetables and a customer came like within 12 inches of my face and was coughing in my face. I just about had a heart attack. I went and dug out," because people had been sending me, every time I did a news report, somebody would send me another box of N95s, So I've got my own little stash, And I remember hauling out a whole box of N95s and telling him, "You make sure you wear these when you go, go in front of." I know I digress, but it's just trying to point out that there are so many people so ineffectively protected, okay? And it didn't have to be. There could have been more of a supply, and the Defense Production Act would have done that. That was the one thing that they could have done. Now, you talk about feelings and how you feel. I should touch on how we felt. I got in the paper for this one too, the day that we got our vaccines, our first vaccines. And I wasn't by any means the first in the state to get it, but I was the first in our hospital, or I was supposed to be the first one in our hospital. And I get it. I was president of M&A and all that kind of stuff, but I certainly qualified. I was a COVID ICU nurse. So I certainly was in the first tier. And they were going to start at 7:30 when I got off my shift. But of course, then they started at 7, and I think a couple of three physical therapists got ahead of me, but I'm the one that they got a picture of, and Dr. Kim gave it to me. And then I was sitting there, waiting to leave, because you had to wait 15, 20 minutes after you had it. And I glanced over, and Dr. Kim was giving a shot to another person. And he seemed to be crying. And I knew that he was probably emotional, because he had probably had family members that had died, just like I did. My father died of COVID. And I remember saying, so much suffering and so much death, but we finally have hope. And of course, I got all teary, even though I have a mask. And the next day, I open up the paper, and there's my picture in the paper with, So it's like the cameramen were waiting for that moment, I'm sure. But it was a sad day, in the sense, it's like anything, when you finally get medical treatment for something, and then you think about how you wish it would have been just there a little bit sooner to save people. So there was a little bit of that going on, but there was a whole lot of joy. You know, I think every nurse on our floor went down to get a shot that day or in the next coming days, and they all took photos and they put them all over Facebook. I mean, it was a joyous occasion for the nurses on my floor. It was, you know, we finally felt like we could do our job and just be just a little bit better protected, you know? I couldn't not touch on that, because you want emotional. That was emotional. That was extremely emotional.
When you're talking, let's shift a little bit to your role. And you've talked about your role as president of the Minnesota mm-hmm. Nurses Association. But what were some of the major focuses, the PPE? Were there any other points that were brought out from nurses across Minnesota saying we need help, or this is the kind of thing that we're facing? Were there any other issues that came up, or were these the same issues that you saw across the state of Minnesota as the pandemic kept going?
Well, like I said at the beginning, from many of the hospitals that weren't hit by COVID, it was hearing about all the hardship of not having their hospital open to procedures. That was huge. It was a huge economic hardship. And then I remember I must have gone to probably 4 or 5 pickets, sidewalk pickets throughout the pandemic in protest because nurses didn't have enough protection. I remember being up there in, what was it, Brainerd, St. Joseph's in Brainerd, which is Senator Gazelka's area, by the way, picketing outside of that hospital, where they were rationing the PPE unnecessarily. They had a doctor in town that had bought every single employee in that hospital a shield. And the person in the hospital who was in charge of it had locked it all up and was rationing it. And it was just like, and I remember running into that surgeon. It was a surgeon in town. And I said, did you realize that those shields that you bought for everybody did not get handed out to everybody? You know what I mean? So all the hospitals, a lot of the hospitals were so concerned about their supply. You know, I don't want to totally lay blame, because we were all in a real pickle. You know what I mean? But you had a situation where they didn't know how much they were going to be inundated with COVID. And so they were being rationing, because they didn't know if they're going to been able to get their next shipment, which caused a lot of stress, because you got the nurses and the workers going, we're not being protected and they're not taking care of us. And you've got administration, who I would meet with administration also. And they'd be saying, but we don't have the supplies coming in. You know, and everyone's at everybody's throat. And of course, I'm sitting here on a global sense just going, get the Defense Production Act going, for God's sake. And that first year was extremely hard, because you had everybody at everyone's throat trying to vie for very finite resources. Okay. And with no help from the top.
And so that sense of competition, there was even competition at the local level, or concern about it.
Oh, yes.
Concern about access. Yeah.
Oh, yes. And then the fact that we weren't counted right away in the to be able to count it for workers' comp either. So you had nurses that did get sick, and then they had a hard time justifying to their employers that they got the COVID at the hospitals. You know, so we had a lot of nurses that were lost a lot of, had to use up the, all of their PTO time and use up their retirement funds and their 401ks and things like that. But that happened to a lot of workers. That's why we pushed this essential workers bill that, you know, they've got the $250 million that have been allotted for that. That's what's behind that, is because we have so many essential workers that have lost pay, having to be out because they had a quarantine, you know, and things like that, either with sick children or sick family members or be out themselves. And they've lost pay because they've needed to be out on the front lines. You know, we can't do our work from home. Anyway, that's what's behind that essential workers. And so as president of M&A, I've been front and center on that whole bill. That's what I've been doing this in 2021 here, is going to many, many, many committee hearings, many press conferences. I'll be doing my hopefully my last one on this issue. I'll be coming up this Thursday, because they're supposed to come up with a decision on it, how the money's going to be dispersed this Thursday. I will once again be doing it after I get off the night shift, because that's how it always is. You know, I get off the night shift to throw a little makeup on and I get in my car and drive down there and do a press conference. I just, please reroute me if I go off. But you know, the thing was, is that because I have almost all the Facebook pages, you know, all the M&A Facebook pages. And so I would, because I'm a night nurse, at any given time, I'm up 24 hours a day. And I would respond to nurses at 3 a.m. that had messaged me on Facebook, begging me for PPE, begging for more staffing, begging for more resources, you know, and people don't realize that I was I'm the sounding board for so many people that are so discouraged. And it wasn't, and you know, and I would call these nurses back and I would talk to them. And sometimes that's all they needed, is to know that somebody was hearing them. Just like I was in front of those reporters going, is anybody listening to me? You know?
Can you speak a bit more about that balance between your union voice and your ICU nursing voice, and how that changed over the last 18 or so months?
The ICU?
Your voice as union leadership, but also your voice as a nurse, and how you balance that.
So, you know, the way I always, always, always introduce myself as, hi, I'm Mary Turner, president of Minnesota Nurses Association, but more importantly, and I used to say an ICU nurse, but more importantly, I'm a COVID ICU nurse at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale. So for me, they're a little bit one in the same. And you know, actually, my boss did me actually a favor by making us the COVID ICU. I mean, if you think about it politically, she did me a favor because it gave me the opportunity to be that voice for the pandemic. Because I'm the only one out of so many, many people that actually had the protection as a union president and a high profile union president, to be able to speak about the pandemic, especially when people wanted to just hide it. Okay. And so to me, the roles are very much blended together. They really are. I mean, I'll work this weekend, and immediately after I get off of work, I will start right away back into my president. It all just kind of rolls together. I don't work as much as some of my coworkers, but I work enough. I work enough. I work probably 20 hours a week, you know, just enough to know what's going on. But I'm also in all the management meetings, because I'm at the management meetings at the hospital level, the state level, the federal level. So, and I guess I use, and every time I need a little bit more newer information, all I have to do is go back to work And which leads me now to the fourth wave, folks. We're in the fourth wave. And I should talk about how what our feelings are this time, because they're far different. You know, Adam and Barbara, it was the first time it was like we had no hope, but we had certainly compassion for everyone coming in. You know what I mean? And at any given time, I remember that first month, it was mainly the people from the cruise ships, the vacationers. That was who was the first month. And then after that, it was the elderly. And then at any given time, and I will say this throughout the whole pandemic and even now, 2/3 of our people on our floor are people of color. So when they say this was an equity issue, they're absolutely right. 2/3 of our ICU at any given time is people from the BIPOC community. Okay. So when I went to the federal level, I may not have always had all the data, the one with all the data, but I'm the eyewitness to the data. Okay. I'm the one that verifies at the federal level what the data shows. And it shows that people of color are filling up 2/3 and doing most of the dying, that and the elderly. But where did I want to go with this? At the time, like I said before, you know, we did the best we could. We cared for everyone. But then the vaccine came along. And people started getting the vaccine and the numbers started going down. And we actually had not too long ago, we actually had probably a week, maybe 2 weeks of no COVID. We didn't have one single COVID on our floor that whole weekend. And we're all kind of like, oh my goodness, we made it. We made it. We did it. We're done. Until the fourth wave came. And the very next weekend that I worked, and everyone coming in unvaccinated. And this time unvaccinated because of the Delta virus, the variant. And what was so shocking is that before this, people, you know, you'd come in, you have a hard time breathing, and you maybe start on a little bit of oxygen, and then you get on the high flow oxygen. And then if you're unfortunate, you end up in the ICU and you may be intubated. And then if you're really unfortunate, you may end up on your stomach intubated. This is what was so shocking about that one weekend. Three people, bam, 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 came into the emergency room, immediately intubated and immediately on their stomach. That's how sick they are with this Delta variant. There's no stopping at go. It's just intubated on your stomach. And most of these people, if they're like that, are dying. Versus the beginning, you remember, we had a lot of success stories where people got better and got out of there. This is nothing to fool around with. And so I remember that first weekend talking to a few nurses because I knew we had to have this discussion. I said, how do you feel about now? Because once again, we're at risk. You know, we're not totally back to one mask and throw it away, not by a long shot. So we're at risk again. And we, as some of us, not me, but some of my nurses have children that can't be vaccinated. And I said, how do you feel about taking care of these people who are unvaccinated? Do you feel resentful? I said, because we have to talk about this, because we need to talk about it out here so that when we go into the room, we can still give compassionate care. Because those kind of feelings need to be addressed. Because, you know, one nurse who said, well, Mary, it's no different than taking care of people who are drunk. Well, yes, it is, because I can't get drunk from taking care of a person who's drunk. You know, but so it was, I very actively had that conversation with the nurses, because it's extremely important to to go through those feelings so that it doesn't hinder our care when we go into those rooms. Because it is different this time.
Is it a surprise to you that you're facing an unvaccinated population at a time when there is a vaccine?
Is it a surprise? No, because we knew all along, just because of the political, you know, back on the Dr. James Hildreth, he's one of the doctors that is on the COVID federal task force. He'd said 15% will never get vaccinated. And he was saying, but if we get 85% vaccinated, we'll have enough to have herd immunity. You know, so I knew right away that there's going to be 15% like anything that won't get vaccinated. But then it was, and if in the very beginning it was 80, we need 85%. Well, then when they backed down to 70%, I remember asking at the state level, I said, why did we change from 85 down to 70? What's so wonderful about 70? And I was told at the time, well, at 70%, we'd still be able to manage it. Well, I don't know about that. All the beds are filled, you know, and maybe that would have been true if all of the states that are only at 35% or 40 had been at 70%. Maybe that concept would have been true. But you guys know that last weekend, they had 29 requests from out of state for ICU beds. We were able to accommodate 12. I talked to some nurses at Abbott. We're getting patients from out of state. I mean, way out of state, not just across the border. And so, as soon as the 70%, so right away I knew, well, that's not going to be enough. But it's still a shock. And what is such a shock is to see how sick they're getting, because as this virus progresses, the variants become stronger and stronger. I think that's how that science goes. And now Governor Waltz today is saying we're going to be living with the COVID for years. So I don't know what that means. And here's another sad state of affairs is that we have to deal with is that now I know at our hospital, we have like 16 ICU nurses that are leaving the ICU for other positions. They say, we don't want to do it anymore. We don't want to do a fourth wave or a fifth wave. That's alarming. Healthcare workers, we're a finite resource right now. And then I don't, you know, you guys, I probably don't care about this, but now we've got this mandating of the vaccine. Hey, I am all for the vaccine, but this is a tough choice for our employers, because that's what we're dealing with now at a, you know, where we're bargaining for effects, we're bargaining over this. And I kind of go, is this really the time that you want to be giving people ultimatums? When you've got people leaving the field like crazy, is this really what you want to do? But, you know, and of course, I've got nurses on both sides. I've got the nurses that are saying everybody should be vaccinated or they should be fired. And then you've got the nurses, personal freedom, you know, and everybody wants me to come out and say something about it. But here's the stance that I have to take as a union leader. I have to be careful what kind of stance I take, because if I sit and say, if M&A comes out with a stance that says that, yes, the hospitals have a right to mandate the vaccine, then that takes away the right for my nurses to fight back if they want to. Now, would their fight be futile? Probably. But I can't take away their union right to fight back. Does that make sense? I can't take away their right to grieve it or take it to arbitration or to do. And that's what I have to be careful of as a union leader, is to be able to maintain their right to fight back. And they don't understand that because they want me to come out with a, oh, for or against, or, you know, Mary, go up to the Capitol where all the non-vaxxers are and, you know, and fight for our right for personal choice. And I'm like, guys, I'm a COVID ICU nurse. How in the heck? Really? Really? You think I'm part of me? And that's where the two get mixed up, Adam, is when people expect me to do something, I'm going, you do remember I'm a COVID ICU nurse, right? That has seen all the death and destruction and suffering for the last 20 months, right, guys, right?
Are you saying that you're having to balance politics and science?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. And I'm a science the whole way, you know?
But you have to balance the reality.
Oh, yes.
The reality of this pandemic is that.
Yes, with the nurses. And you know, without being able, and, you know, we've all got it. I've got my own family members that I can't even discuss this with. So, and you wouldn't believe how many people, because of who I am, how many conspiracy theory things, they send me these things all the time, trying to convince me and convert me. Oh, did you see this new one? Or did you see this new theory or that new theory? And
do you get messaging? Do you get messages from the public or from the nurses or from anyone else criticizing you for stance? Or, you know, some of the people we've interviewed have said that they've gotten some very difficult, you know, been in the public and they've gotten some very difficult email messages or other messages, criticizing and in ways that are difficult.
Yeah. Well, here's one thing that I realize that it's out there. I realize the job that I have to do. And oftentimes when I glance at an email and I see what the tone is, I may or may not finish reading it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? First and foremost, that you have to learn as a leader, you cannot take things personally.
And so, that's been a kind of a trend that those things have been going on. And that's, I was just wondering if you were part of that.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Okay. Facebook message, you know, they just feel like, you know, and sometimes, here's how I look at it is, because Facebook can be a very destructive thing. And everyone seems to be brave on Facebook. So if I've actually got a nurse that's actually taken the time to actually email me, I actually respect the fact that she emailed me instead of just slapping it up on social media. That's how I look at it. They've actually gotten up enough gumption to do this properly. And so then I respect whatever view that they have. But that's huge, is that you don't take things personally. Because they don't know me, I don't know them.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a trend now, doesn't it?
It seems to be a trend that everybody takes everything personally.
Yeah.
You know, leaders take everything personally. And it's just like everybody has a right to their opinion. Now, that being said, when somebody talked to me about personal freedom, here was my response was, the only one who truly has personal freedom, total personal freedom, is somebody living on an island by themselves. Mm-hmm. Where you have total freedom to do whatever you want, because nobody in this world has total personal freedom. Otherwise, you know, because if we did, we wouldn't have traffic laws. You know, we wouldn't have those accidents in the middle of the night. We every once in a while get somebody that drove the wrong way down the highway and ran into somebody, and that's who ends up in our IC, in our ED at night. You know what I mean? So this whole concept of this personal freedom versus looking out for your fellow humankind here, it's two opposing thoughts that they have, that the political world has deliberately created this dilemma. That's very frustrating. That's very frustrating that this public health crisis has been turned into this political circus. And you guys are the historians. I don't know if this has happened before in other, I don't know what happened in 1918, if they did the same thing in 1918, but they didn't have a vaccination back then. So
they had masks.
They had masks. Yes, they did.
Cloth masks. That's what they
They did.
Really quickly, before we move on, during this interview, you've, I think, very deliberately spoken about yourself and your fellow nurses as workers. And I was hoping you could say why that's important to talk, to speak about them in that manner, as opposed to, I think, a lot of like the national narratives we see of, as nurses as kind of these figures we put on pedestals. And, you know, what it means to you to recognize nurses as kind of laborers in a very specific sense.
You mean on pedestals, like hero worshiping and calling us angels and all that other business?
Exactly.
You know, that got old really fast, especially when they weren't giving us any protection. And I remember the very first time, it was at a essential worker. It was the spring of 2020, and we were down by one of the statues at the foot of the Capitol steps. And that was the first time that I said, you know, we don't want to be called heroes. We don't want to be called angels. All we want is personal protective equipment. You can keep all the adoration. Just give us a mask. And everybody, all the other essential workers there, the restaurant workers and the housekeepers and the security, were all like, yeah, we're, you know. Yeah, because some of those professions got even less. And that's why I, you know, is when I started to hobnob with all the rest of them. And I have heard stories from the meat packers to the bus drivers to the, and heard all in all different languages. Okay, Adam, I've been around all of these. And so I very much think of our nurses as, we are workers. We're the frontline workers. And that's the category that I am proud to say that we're in. And you can, now it's one thing for me to say to each other, for us to say to each other, we are kind of heroic. From the first moment that we took on this pandemic and went to all of our jobs without proper protection, we were heroes. But it's one thing for us to say to each other that we're heroes, but it's others to say, oh, you're so wonderful. You're heroes. You're so wonderful. And then not bother to protect us. Or even worse now, what my fellow nurses down south have to put up with, being harassed on the streets and told that they're just keeping this going, that this is all make-believe. Some of the treatment that healthcare workers are experiencing in the south is just appalling. We're not heroes anymore. They're not heroes down there. They're the people that are keeping this myth going. That's extremely hard. That's heartbreaking to hear. We haven't had to experience that here. It depends who you're talking to, you know, but I try not to talk to those people. The ones who try to say that it doesn't exist. Yeah.
That must be a hard thing to face as you're treating everyone for working with a terrible disease that others deny exists.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. I think I remember that. I think it was on one of the governor. You remember he would have his one of his first little
news conferences.
News conferences, and that's when I described the people dying alone without their families. And that actually was kind of cool, because it was after that news report that I did, that a local charitable organization donated like 80 some iPads to the hospitals for that specific use. That was pretty cool, actually. Because I was describing how the ICU patients couldn't see their families and stuff. So they donated all these iPads to all the hospitals. I thought that was pretty cool.
There have been stories that as people are dying, they're actually denying, I can't be dying of COVID. Is that, I've seen that, is that the reality or is an urban myth or
so,
anything?
No,
very quickly,
so just, some of our Dakota nurses, South Dakota nurses, because that in the National Nurses United, I've also done forums and stuff. And one South Dakota nurse was describing how a patient would rather be told that they have cancer than have COVID. Can you believe that? They'd rather have cancer than COVID. And I couldn't help but their job must be 100 times harder because they're taking care of people that are in the, denying it. And I can't even imagine how it must be to try to get them to do what they need to do when they're in such denial. But we're even seeing that we had one pulmonary doc that was talking to one of our family members of these people that are coming in unvaccinated. And he said how he was talking to them kind of going, well, are you guys going to get vaccinated now? Are you going to start wearing masks? And they're like, no, it didn't matter that mother was dying. It didn't matter that mother died. They're still going to stick with their no vaccine and their no mask. See, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It's mind boggling how senseless this all is. And this is where I go back, and you can put this in history if you want or not, but I lay a blame for all of this kind of attitude on one person. On one person who could have made a difference. Our past president. And to see him try now, it's a little bit too late. And it's been, to say that I've been extremely frustrated throughout this whole thing is an understatement of the year. Because I on the one hand, but on the other hand, I feel blessed that I have been able to see it at all the way from the local level, all the way to the federal level. And being able to have all the different perspectives. So I actually am a pretty good candidate for this kind of thing, this oral history. Yeah. Well, and that, I don't know if you want to hear about the federal task force, but that has been a real eye opener in the sense of finding out just how inequitable a lot of our systems are.
Go ahead. Let's, in fact, that's something we did want to get to. If you want to talk about that a little bit, talk the inequitable or the inequities of the medical system or that you've seen or in the system.
So how it worked is we had like 5 months of topics. It was the vaccine hesitancy, then it was the mental health, and then it was the COVID, and then it was PPE. And resources and stuff. And then it was post pandemic. Anyway, we had, and we would have community experts for all the different months. And just some of the stories that we would hear from some of these experts, I'll never forget when they talked about the prisons. And then I was actually able to talk to nurses that worked in our prisons here in Minnesota. And how they had no resources and how they had to try to keep people quarantined with no hospital wards and no, you know, and it's just like, you know, on the one hand, you've got a population that so many people would say, well, they did whatever wrong. And so now they deserve what they get. But on the other hand, it's kind of like, yes, but once you put these people in the prison, we're responsible as a state to care for them while they're in there, okay? Just like I'm responsible to take care for that unvaccinated COVID patient. Whether I agree with their decisions or not, that is not for me to say, okay? And so to hear some of the stories about their isolation techniques were to just put people in a solitary confinement. with just a blanket and a hard, cold bed to lay on. No oxygen, no, you know what I mean? So some of the stories were like heart-wrenching for me. And then they talked about how, at the very time that they were having the interview, they said that they were trying to get the vaccines out to people. And one of the inmates was having a reaction as they were talking to us, and they're trying to get this person help. Well, I was just frantic. I was like, my mind was totally off. It's like, well, are they getting that person to the hospital? You know what I mean? So I heard some very alarming. And then I remember the long COVID, hearing about, because the thing with the long COVID is people are having a hard time getting people to believe them, you know, and especially people of color. There was one young lady that said she went to the emergency 12 times before somebody would stop and listen to her and believe her. So
are you seeing that there's a role for the MNA there, an increasing role, a changing role maybe, or role that the pandemic has shown more light on in terms of helping us understand how to identify and deal with some of the difficulties, the systemic racism, or what's sometimes called medical racism?
Well, that's been, so that's some of our recommendations coming out at the federal level, is that the algorithms that they use in the medical profession, the technology that you use, when you hear about, have you heard about like the spirometer? You know what a spirometer is? That's the breathing. Well, it's supposedly that piece of equipment is designed with the concept that Blacks have 10 to 12% less lung function, and Asians have 4 to 6% less lung function than whites. And which isn't true at all. All of that is just malarkey. But what happens is that when you get into the further down the line, when you got people into rehab and things like that, they're going to have inaccurate readings when they use these spirometers, which is going to affect what care that they get. Or the oximeters that we use, that was the huge one. And I brought that up when we use the oximeters. That's huge. The one on the finger, the finger probe, the pulse ox. Mm-hmm. So that piece of equipment was designed and probably tested on a thin skin white male, not taking into account skin thickness or melatonin. And so you could have a Black person that would have their pulse ox, and they could potentially be reading higher because it's inaccurate than maybe Adam, a white male. And so Adam, you'll come in and your oxygen level may go 84, and we'll go, oh, Adam, we need to get you right in, get you on high flow oxygen, et cetera. And a Black person would come in and it would read maybe 93 and it'd be going, oh, you're short of breath. They'd either say, we don't believe you, or go home till you feel worse. You see what I'm saying? What happens when you've got equipment that is not tested on all different and designed for all different racial, it can affect your level of care. It can lead to denying of care. You know, why was this person sent home 12? Why was this young Black woman sent home 12 times? What pieces of equipment were they using that weren't truly testing, you know, and verifying what she was saying? You see where the problem comes in? It's huge.
Was this something that you are more aware of now because
the pandemic
helped bring that to the fore, or bring it identified more, have it be identified?
What brought it? It was me being on the federal task force, because this is the kind of stuff we discussed. And the first one is, so I go back to Dr. James Hildreth, and he's on there, and he's like president of a few Black colleges down in Tennessee. And he's also, he's also one of the guys that like is on the committees to okay the vaccines. I mean, he's the doctor I listen to, okay? It's like when we talk about doctors. And he was the one who first brought that up. And then I, at one point this past winter, I had a, where I just called him and I said, hey, do you want me to start working on a, some recommendation and problem statements in regards to this? I'd be glad to take that on. And so he kind of came up with the idea and steered me in the right direction. And then we're going to have whole recommendations about that. Because that's huge. That's huge. When I found that out, I was like, I immediately thought what that means in the hospital, even. That makes a difference whether you get believed in the emergency room and you get admitted to the hospital or not. It's huge. It's huge.
And that's the kind of sort of built-in racism. We talk about the impact of George Floyd and just the fact that there was so much going on in Minnesota at the time, but this, the subtleties of the racism that you're talking about that we almost take for granted, we don't understand or we don't see right away.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to change at the federal level. And I have to put in this plug. It was so funny because, I mean, it's no secret that the nurses are for Medicare for all. But it was so funny that every problem we would come up with, inevitably somebody would say, well, Mary, you do know that the only way to change that is for get Medicare for all. That was 80%. And at one point, Jolinda Johnson from FEMA said, you know, about 80% of the problems would be solved with a different healthcare system. Yeah. You know,
well, maybe so that is, maybe the pandemic is drawing an attention to that as well.
Oh, definitely. Well, we certainly are. We certainly are. Because that was the conclusions we just kept coming up with, that with the present system, the way it is now, the for-profit system, we can only be able to do so much. And that this system has led to all these inequities and led to a pandemic that has not been very well managed by any means. No.
Good point. Interesting point to make. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Adam, did you have any other questions? We've gone over your hour. I want to keep an eye on the time. Adam, do you have any other?
Oh, an hour and a half. Wow. So you get me talking.
Yeah. I think we've covered so many topics and, you know, we've touched on a lot of the ones I had too. Maybe just to give you a chance, if there's anything about the last 18 months that we haven't talked about that you would like to say on the historical record. And that,
Well, I would like to say that despite our, you know, in Minnesota being a fourth wave, I really felt I should address this because he took so much criticism for his executive orders. But I'll tell you what, he wasn't the only one doing those executive orders. Most of the governors had those executive orders in place just as long as Governor Waltz did. But we are so fortunate that we had the leadership that we did. And that he took that on and was able, because there is no way if we would have had, you know, the decisions that he had to make, the spur of the moment, and day by day and working with the other governors, if we would have had to wait for the legislature, that we're one of the, I think, well, what are we, the only divided in the country? We would have been like down south right now. So I feel like for history, Minnesota's history's sake, I need to give kudos to Governor Waltz for his courage to take on that role. And, you know, he took a bad flack for being, you know, overbearing and all that other kind of stuff, but it's exactly what we needed at the time. When your state is in crisis, you need a strong leader that's going to be willing to put up with the people picketing and rioting outside of their house and death threats. And at one point he had to move his 13-year-old son out of the governor's mansion. He put up with all of that for the people of Minnesota. And I commend his courage on that. So I do want to do kudos to him. You can let him know I said that.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that about covers our questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we say thank you?
No, hopefully it all made sense. Sometimes I feel like I ramble, but you guys can put it all into a semblance.
Well, we'll send you the transcript too, yeah. And you can look at it. And also check our spelling on names and that sort of thing. But covered, we had a list of questions, and thank you for covering them.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
I was a little intimidated at first by all of them, but I think I got them all. So
thank you very, very much.
And we'll
turn this around and get the transcript to you. And then if you have any questions, you may let us know.
All right.
I appreciate very much your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you. All right. Have a good day.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.